I noticed on the website that this meeting was going to take place. And so I was curious, being that it's not a normal, regular commission meeting, if it would be live streamed. I sent a quick, short email to Jessica asking if it was going to be live streamed. If not, were there any other options for audio and video of the meeting? I never got a response, which is pretty typical, as we all know, of the way the city responds to my questions. So I waited until this afternoon in Cold City Hall and was told that they didn't know, but they would call me back. And they did, and said, no, it's not going to be. And I asked, do you know why? And they said, no. And I said, well, great, can you please connect me with someone who is able to tell me that? I was connected to Mike, got his voicemail, he returned the call. I asked him, he said, no, it's not, because we spoke with the city attorney, and he said, we don't have to. And I thought that was pretty strange. For one thing, that just states to me that you were only going to do the bare minimum. If we had to live stream it, then we would. But other than that, no. That's not polite to the community in the least. Now, I have stated in writing that I am not able to attend meetings because of my health these days. But this got me so worked up, that's why I'm here. I came here to voice my concern about how the live streaming situation was handled, and because I'm so curious as what kind of training is going to go on, I thought I would show up. And so, here I am. And then Jim comes in and starts setting up equipment, so I go over and ask him if he's live streaming, and he says, yes, he is. So I called, because I'm not feeling well at all, I called my ride and said, okay, I'll be ready by 6. It was shortly after I made that call that Jim came to me and said, you know, I don't know if we're going to do live streaming. They're going to discuss it. So I don't know why you decided not to live stream it, why you feel that it's not in the community's best interest to know what you're doing. Certainly it doesn't fall in under the Open Meetings Act. But just because you don't have to doesn't mean you shouldn't. Now on to one quick other subject. I have for a long time now been challenging city government to a debate, not an argument, a debate under normal debate rules. I recently reaffirmed that challenge and upped the offer by saying I would donate $100 to the charity of your choice if y'all will accept the debate challenge. And this was directed to Mayor Conklin, and I suspected that I would be debated, if I debated, I would be debating both Mike and Hugh, and I fully accept that. Not only that, I will now extend that offer and say I would like to debate every person on the committee at once. You all can tag team me in a debate. You get to choose the moderator. I will provide that $100 donation at the start, to the charity of your choice, at the start of the debate. I further expand this and say this. I asked Commissioner Tim how much the city pays the attorney. The city attorney, he said $150 an hour. I would like to include the city attorney in that debate also. I will not only debate the entire commission and the city manager, but also the city attorney, and I will pay $300 for 2 hours of his time. And if it doesn't last 2 hours, it's still the $300. I'm willing to put up $400 to debate on the main issues facing this community, and I see no other way to handle this as you have repeatedly refused to answer my questions. Commissioner Tim called me, left a message, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to get to the phone. Sometimes people are in the basement. He left a message. I had, in response to my complaint, that no one's getting back to me. And I expected an apology for the dismissive comment he made at me at the previous meeting. His message that he left said nothing about any concern that I misunderstood his comment, or that he made a poorly worded comment, or wished to apologize. The only thing he wanted to do was discuss my questions. I don't want to discuss my questions. I have posed my questions. I wanted answers.
Chip, you're down to 30 seconds.
Thank you. Last summer, I had asked questions of Michael Caine, and he said, Chad, the best way to handle this is to meet. And I did so, and when I got there, all he wanted to do was discuss. He had my questions in writing, and what did he say to me? Okay, Chad, what are your questions? That's why I don't want to discuss anything with anybody. Thank you for your time.
All right. So, introduce our guests here, Michael and Christopher. Could you just introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about yourself, and we can get into the agenda?
Sure. My name is Michael Vespucci. I'm an accountant with the Michigan Unit Affiliate. Been here about 3 years. I'm in charge of the league's financial statements, as well as several of the affiliates, the Mayor's Association, the Municipal Attorneys Association, and several other aspects at the league.
I'm Chris Johnson. I'm the general counsel for the Michigan Municipal League, so that's my first time away from being in private practice. I actually practiced municipal law for almost 40 years with my law firm, Johnson & Tide. We defended governments all over the state of Michigan, so it's been a real pleasure to do that. In addition, I'm a recovering politician. I spent 12 years on a school board, and then after that I was the mayor of my community for 28 years. So I had to run 14 different times, and 3 different times on the school board. So I'm familiar with your side of the table as well, not only having to walk the walk, or talk the talk, I've had to walk the walk as well. So that's a little bit about my background. Let's see.
So Chris, before you go any further, Mike, did you have any plans of like eating, or we're going to be working on a half hour and then a 15-minute break? Is that kind of
I'd leave it up to Chris to talk about the agenda and how he wants to go forward with it. The food's here whenever you want to, and you'll need to move over to the tab with the mouse to get to the presentation that's at the top of the screen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, click on that the first one in my head.
There we go.
And then push the down button to advance it. It's kind of counterintuitive.
Okay, we're first going to do rules and responsibilities. And for some reason, it's got a little bit mixed up. I'm going to move then to the Freedom of Information Act. And we'll then take a break after that. And maybe take a break so you can get some food to start with. There's no sense in letting food get cold. And then we'll come back and I'll do the Open Meetings Act, which I think is probably one of the most significant issues that you'll have to deal with as a member. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Michigan Municipal League itself. We have about 525 members at our cities, villages, and a few urban townships as well. We provide a lot of different services to our communities. And probably one of the most important ones is our advocacy program. We have a team of 4 individuals that are in Lansing all the time trying to keep the legislature from doing bad things to you. They do it on a routine and regular basis, and we try to lessen the impact of that. We also have a special finance initiative going on that's called Save My City, and it's really interesting that the legislature has reduced revenue sharing to our communities for the past many years. Not only do we have to deal with the Headley Amendment and having to go to local voters every time we want to increase or just not be rolled back as far, the legislature has also given us this problem.
Chris?
Yes.
Jump in for a second, just to let everybody know, in the blue folders that you have here, is a complete slide-by-slide copy of this presentation. If you want to follow that and make notes on a certain slide that he brings up, it might be helpful for you.
Thank you. Will there be an electronic slideshow, right? Can you share with us?
Excuse me?
Any electronic slideshow? With what you got here that you're going over?
I can, Mike has it, so.
Yes, we do have it.
Just you should know that Michigan municipalities have lost $8.6 billion in revenue sharing from 2002 until 2017. And that's really significant because if you look at the share that Boyd City has lost for $2 million, he'd be in a much better financial position if you had that in your fund balance. So when a state legislator says to you, you don't know how to budget and you don't know what you're doing in terms of financing, you can look right back in the eye and say, no, you're the ones that are doing it to us. We also have a resource called our inquiry service. So if you call this number or send a question to info@mml.org, you'll find that we can get some pretty good answers to you fairly quickly. We try to respond within 24 hours, depending on the nature of the ask, and I think it's a really good service for you to use. We also have on our website about 70+ one-pager pluses, we call them, on various topics that involve municipal government, everything from the Open Meetings Act to zoning to virtually anything you can think of. So we're not trying to replace somebody's city attorney, but we are trying to provide information. I'm available to your city attorney at any time if he wants to discuss various matters, and I'm always happy to kick those around. We also have a number for our new municipal officials. And if you'd like a copy of it, just let Mike know and we'll send a few copies up. Very valuable in terms of just finding out what municipal government's all about. So the next thing I'd like to cover is local government in the state of Michigan. And what this is going to do is be a short course of something that, you know, we spend semesters in law school, actually. So we'll talk about the origins of local government forms and functions, and the role of the council, or in your case, commission, mayor, and the manager. One thing that I think you need to understand is local government in Michigan constantly evolves. It's changing all the time. So you can't say, I know what it is today, and I'm all set. We're subject to the legislative whims. We're subject to changes made by the court system, both the Court of Appeals and the Michigan Supreme Court. All these different factors change the way we do business on a regular basis. So you always need to be keeping up with the law, not only the statutory law that the legislature gives us, but the case law that the courts hand down to us. And by definition, we're a political subdivision, so we owe our existence to the state constitution, which means we have to follow the state constitution. We have to follow the state statutes. And even though you may have a charter provision that says we're going to do it this way, if a state law says you will do it that way instead, you have to follow the state law. And there's an interesting provision in the Michigan Constitution as well, Article 7, Section 22 and 34, which actually creates home rule and gives us the ability to have home rule cities. And in our case here at Boyd City, we do have a home rule city. So again, I want to emphasize that legislation will change. Sometimes it allows you to do certain things, sometimes it prohibits you from doing certain things. For example, right now, the league has been fighting against a bill that would allow 30% of the community to become a short-term rental, whether you like it or not. You may have your own short-term rental ordinance here. If you do, that will be thrown out if that particular bill gets passed. So that's why I was talking about the legislative service that we do. We find that when you get involved as local officials, you know, I'm the city council member, I'm the mayor, and this is what we'd like to see in our community, you know, you have an effective, powerful voice, and we recommend that you use it. Court opinions really do change things. For example, the Bolt decision in the city of Lansing case, which kind of turned fees and taxes all around, and it's a very difficult case to understand, but we also have issues with how do you interpret that, and staying up on top of that drives us municipal attorneys nuts. And finally, if you don't believe it, public opinion has a lot to do with local government authority. If you look out in your meeting sometime, there's 200 people here, you know something happened. And I don't mean to be, you know, crazy about it, but I knew in my community, if we had 50 people show up at a meeting, we were going to hear about it, and something was amiss. So public opinion will also have some effect. We have a number of different kinds of government in the state of Michigan. First of all, we have counties, and those are delegated powers that counties have. So in other words, we have 83 Michigan counties, and there's a statute specific to counties, and those statutes spell out exactly what a county can do. If it's not in the statute, then the county can't do it. It's that simple. We have cities as the next level of government in the state, and we have 280 cities in the state of Michigan. And there are different kinds of cities. There's a home rule, which we have here. There's fourth and fifth class cities, which are being rolled into home rule cities as time goes by. And we have one special charter city in the state. And for bonus points in a competition sometime, that special charter is the city of Mackinac Island. So they're special because they have a special charter. It's kind of interesting. We also have 253 villages in the state of Michigan, which is kind of interesting. And they're very interesting because they remain part of the township as well. And then we have 1,240 townships in the state of Michigan, which also includes 136 charter townships. So if somebody says we have a lot of government in the state of Michigan, yes, we do. We have lots of government in the state of Michigan. But if you make a proposal to change any of it, or reduce down the number of governments we have, you will really run into a buzzsaw because they've tried that before and it doesn't go very far. And finally, we also have a lot of special purpose units of government. School districts are their own government, intermediate school districts, police authorities, recreation authorities, library authorities, drainage districts are government. So you can see we have a whole different set of things that really come into play. Now, as I mentioned before, we have a home rule city here, and this particular section of the Constitution gives us more power than, say, the general average township would have. And it's actually enshrined in our Constitution, which is a real positive thing for home rule cities. Our charter in the city is the equivalent of a constitution, either at a state or federal level. So it's the basic document that governs the city. And I always recommend to every new elected official and every seasoned official that you should read your charter and read it often. That sets out exactly what you can do and how you do it. Sets out the roles and responsibilities of the staff and of the members of the commission. It has to include things like election, how you elect the mayor, how you elect the commissioners. It has to have a tax rate in there not to exceed. It has to provide that you follow the Open Meetings Act and protect the peace, health, and safety of your citizens. A charter may include several things if you go through the Home Rule Cities Act, and that would be things like water and sewer, streets and roads, special assessments. Those are permissible but not mandatory sections of a charter. And there's at least one item that's prohibited from being in your charter, and that's to have a milage rate in excess of 20 mils. You simply can't go above that. Now, as we mentioned, the charter is much like the Constitution. Your ordinances are much like a state statute, either a state or federal statute. It's a local legislative act, and it brings the power of law to your city. So you can prohibit certain activities, you might require certain activities to happen by way of an ordinance, but it is a specific action that you take. And while you may pass a resolution in certain cases, say honoring an individual or expressing some sort of preference, you need to have an ordinance to give it the effect of law. Now, your charter is kind of interesting because it spells out in sections, chapters 5, 6, and 7 of your ordinance, the roles of the city commission and the role of the administration. And this actually governs what happens in the city and how it happens. And I think that's an important thing. That's another reason to go back and reread the charter to understand what those roles are. Now, you also have to remember you're limited. You control what happens in the city, but you don't control what other units of government do. You don't control what your neighbors necessarily do. You don't run the county, for example. You just have to remember that you're limited to what goes on here. So as we kind of look at your roles, I think your success will depend ultimately on how you will deal with that. And understanding your role is really kind of the core bedrock of how successful the community will be. And again, those are all spelled out in the city charter, and I recommend that you read them. The city commission then is responsible for the policy making of the community. You set long-term and short-term goals. You're responsible for adopting a budget and a capital improvement plan. And you can only act as a body through your resolutions and your ordinances. That's a very important part to understand. And putting your goals and objectives together with the budget is a very important thing. Let's take an example. You all ran on a platform of let's fix the damn roads. Worthy goal, no doubt about it. But if you only put $1.98 in the budget to fix the roads, guess how many roads are you gonna actually fix? So if you don't line up your budget and your priorities in the budget and your capital improvement plan with your goals and objectives, you're doomed to failure. You're just not going to meet your goals and objectives. And it also isn't necessarily fair to say, okay, you had $1.98 to work on the roads, city administration. Why aren't the roads fixed? Well, you're going to have to look in the mirror and say, well, we only gave you $1.98, and we couldn't fix any roads with $1.98. So it's really important then that you line up those goals and objectives with your budget. And you should have the ability to set rules and procedures that the council or commission will follow. It's very important to do that because it eliminates a lot of chaos later on down the road. As I mentioned before, you might only act as body. You don't act as individual commission members. You don't have the ability for the right to walk in and tell the director of DPW to go plow my street first because I think it's the most important one in the city. You're just one member of the commission. and you still need a majority of the commission to act on any particular item. And as you provide direction to the administration, it's important that the majority of you do so, so that the direction is clear and the manager and the administration can follow that direction. The mayor had, or presiding officer, if we're in the case of a planning commission or something along that line, has a major role in how the community will perceive you. You're required to acknowledge members wishing to speak and being courteous to the members of the council and the public, and to fairly enforce the rules of the council. For example, if the mayor is only calling on one council member as opposed to all of the council members in turn, the public will notice that. And I think you will get a feeling from the community that you are being out there, if you're that obvious about it. You should also fairly enforce the public comment portion of the meeting, and we'll deal with that in a little bit more detail in terms of the Open Meetings Act and what's required and what's not required. And one of the things I think that is really important for the mayor or presiding officer in any situation is to keep control of the meeting. Questions should be run through the chair, not to individuals on the commission. Should not. You basically are required to kind of step up and be that person that is actually running the meeting. Sometimes you get a question from the audience. It might be able to be answered really quickly. For example, you know, when does this program start? And somebody knows that it starts on May the 1st. Yeah, just simple, yeah, courtesy. Somebody presents you a list of 30 questions during public comment that can't be answered in, you know, the 2 minutes. You're actually not under any obligation to be answering questions during a public meeting if you don't want to. Unfortunately, the gentleman was incorrect in terms of what the Open Meetings Act requires or doesn't require. I recommend that you don't engage in a debate with various members of the audience during the meeting because it's counterproductive. You're not necessarily changing people's minds unless it's an effective, you know, exchange. Every once in a while, I can still remember a meeting, somebody got up at public comment and said, hey, did you ever think of doing it this way? And, you know, we thought about it for a moment, and we hadn't thought of it. So guess who was on the committee the next day? You know, and actually we ended up going in the direction that that citizen had recommended. And it was very good, very good comment. Now, city manager form of government really came into existence in the early part of the 20th century and was an attempt to bring some more professional management to a city. Prior to that time, the only qualification for running the city was to get more votes than the other person. That doesn't necessarily qualify you to run a wastewater treatment plant or a water supply. It doesn't, you know, teach you how to budget. Yeah, I got more votes than Mike here, but it doesn't mean I'm more qualified to hold that position. So it was an attempt to bring professionals into management, and you can see it's a very popular form of government in Michigan, as 234 of our 280 cities have city managers. So that kind of speaks to the overwhelming like of it. The manager is responsible for achieving commission goals and is responsible to report that status to you as a commission. As I mentioned before, it's very important to sync up your goals and your budget and then see how you're doing with that. The manager is responsible for the day-to-day operations, and I can tell you without a doubt that when I have a citizen call my house and say, you know, they didn't pick up the garbage, I was always lucky to be able to say, I'll get a hold of the manager and the manager will fix that. I'm not going to run out and personally pick up your garbage today. And if you compare it to a corporate structure, you're probably looking at the manager as being the CEO of the organization or a corporate structure. I think it's very important that you think about the kind and content of the communication that you want to have with the manager. What information do you really need? You need to know probably about critical infrastructure. You need to know about what budget priorities are because you're helping to make those priorities. Do you really need to know where you buy the pencils? Do you really need to know the minutia of, you know, where the tape is what? You know, those sorts of things kind of get silly if you get down to that particular level of trying to manage the city. That's what the administration is for. And another thing is, I think is very true, and I always tried to do this while I was mayor. I had a question from a fellow council member, in your case a commission member, who wanted to know about whatever it is. If it's important enough for you to know, it's probably important enough for all of you to know. And so, you know, sharing that information is very, very important, I think. Because when you play gotcha at meetings, it's really a problem. You'll be destroying your relationships with each other. It's just not a healthy situation. I had a council member who liked to play that little game, and he was always resented by staff. But interestingly enough, he always made himself look bad because the information that he was asking a question about was usually in the packet of information that had been submitted, and he hadn't read his packet. So he's sitting there trying to play gotcha, and he's looking like a fool to the general public out there. Oh yeah, it's on page 3. Didn't you read the packet we sent to you? So don't play that game with each other. Don't play that game with your staff. It leads to very unhealthy relationships. As I mentioned before, and I'll mention it 1,000 times, we need to act as a body. And, you know, to get your particular views to or priorities passed, you need to convince at least 2 other members of your commission as to what your position is. So it really should be the top of your mind to give respect so that you earn respect. I'm reminded of a Saturday Night Live skit from the very early days where Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin are sitting there doing the news, and Dan whips his head around and says, "Jane, you ignorant slut." Well, guess what? You do that to somebody and you have lost them forever. They will never respect you again. They will not play ball with you again. And someday you may need their vote, but you've just antagonized the person sitting next to you by making a terrible, thoughtless comment like that. So extend those courtesies to each other, even if you just like what their priority is.
With that being said, it's in violation of the Open Meetings Act if I call Marty and Hugh on a certain topic. Is it not? Don't I have to include all 5 of us? Or actually, I should not be doing that.
You should not be doing that. And we'll talk about that in detail during the open meeting session.
Okay.
The rules are really strict on the open meeting session. Ethics. I can't overemphasize ethics and the appearance that you all give to the community about how the community is actually being run. We have an Institute for Local Government, and they have 4 very excellent tenets for following that I strongly recommend. And the first is not to benefit financially from your position. If you get information as a commission member, it might be that the city is interested in purchasing some land, so you run out and buy the land first so you can make a profit on it. That's a pecuniary interest, and you've just involved yourself in a hot mess that probably will turn out bad for you at the next election. But, you know, oh, I made a couple $100,000 here, so it's good. No, it's not. You shouldn't benefit at all from your position other than whatever salary is you're entitled to as compensation. You shouldn't...
Sorry, where does it become criminal?
It usually becomes criminal at the point that you're doing it without any notice to anyone. You're siphoning off funds. you're benefiting with information that was provided to you in confidence, then you're probably on the criminal side. Another thing that I think is important is not to receive a special benefit as a result of your commission membership. Let me give you an example. In my community, I lived on Main Street. City Hall was on Main Street. The fire station was on Main Street. So what was the first house or street that got plowed is Main Street, because we got to make sure the fire station is open in case there's a fire somewhere. And the police station was also in the same building. I lived on Main Street. Every once in a while, they plowed Main Street first because the banners on Main Street. No, it's because the fire station was on Main Street. And I would make that point several times. What was really ironic was my garage and driveway is on a corner lot, and West Street is the street that my driveway is off of, and it was one of the last streets to get plowed, literally. In fact, sometimes it doesn't get plowed, which I remind the city manager of on occasion. So you should still get my street eventually. So don't walk into a restaurant and expect a free meal. I mean, that sort of thing is just so resented by the person that you're taking advantage of that it really isn't worth it. Don't be secretive in your decision making. The Open Meetings Act actually requires that you make all your decisions in public. And the more open you are about the process that you're following, I think the stronger your community will be, because you'll actually have people understanding the rationale behind your decisions. And finally, again, don't let favoritism or bias cloud your decision making. Whether we know it or not, we all have biases. We just do. We're human beings, and we have biases. Probably the most important thing then is to not allow that to get in the way of whether or not you'll consider a certain issue in a certain way. Be open to that other viewpoint. You'll learn a lot by listening. You learn more by listening than you do by talking. I already mentioned it before when that citizen got up and said, you know, hey, have you ever thought about doing it this way? And we hadn't. It can really change the direction of a particular program or decision you might be making. So these are a few ethical standards that are out there in Michigan that you might want to be aware of, and I've listed them here for you. And it's all in the materials that I've given you. And I love this quote from Justice Stewart, who's a former United States Supreme Court justice, which is, what you have the right to do doesn't equal what is right to do. So he also came up with that memorable phrase, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. Social media is a little bit different. It's evolving as we speak, and it's a good tool to communicate. It's also a good tool to miscommunicate or provide false information as well, I suppose. But you need to take care of making sure, if you're using social media, to make sure it's stated, this is my position, this is what Chris Johnson thinks, not what the city thinks. There's two different things, unless the city's already taken a position consistent with what your view was. So you're one member of the commission, you're not the commission. So be careful in your use of social media. I kind of recommend a social media code of conduct that's adopted by the commission that usually can set forth rules that are easier to follow than just sort of going, I wonder if this is really a good thing to do or not. and it helps the public recognize that this is an individual commission member speaking on social media rather than the city. And I don't know if you have liaisons to various boards. A number of communities do. If you're a liaison, the role of the liaison is to transmit the information back and forth. It's to let the city commission know what this board is looking at. It's to let the board know what the city commission is. It's not to influence their decision, oh, you ought to do X. You shouldn't be using a liaison position for that. And I had to constantly remind some of my fellow council members that, especially when they were new, that that's not the role of the liaison. The role of the liaison is back and forth with information. Okay, I think we're done with the roles. And I'm going to move to the freedom of information.
Will there be an opportunity for Chris to ask you questions?
Actually, if you have questions, you can go ahead and ask them as we go along. That way you can get them.
A conflict of interest when you have something we're considering short-term rental. What was the discussion about short-term rental? And George owns a short-term rental in a city yard. And we had a community discussion at December, and George excused himself from that discussion. Is that an appropriate, should he have excused himself?
I think since he directly would be affected by that ordinance personally, as opposed to just generally something happened, it's probably a wise move. It just ruminates even the appearance of a conflict of interest.
Okay. And with the city manager and their role, is it the city manager's, could you talk a little bit about the agenda? You know, whose agenda is it? It has been a question that has come up occasionally.
Ultimately, the agenda belongs to the commission. There are lots of ways to develop an agenda. Some communities like to do it by way of a council member at, you know, a meeting says, I'd like to discuss water rates at a future meeting, and then it gets put on an agenda later on. Sometimes, I guess I can only go to my experience. I used to have conferences with the city manager on a regular basis where we'd be discussing issues that were on the horizon. When does it make sense to bring it to our city council? So we would discuss, you know, timing, that sort of thing. Every once in a while, certain issues sort of develop on their own. 500 people show up at a meeting and they're demanding action. That sort of ends up on the agenda too. So developing some sort of rule or process should be part of your rules and procedures that you have as a community, as a commission. Usually an agenda will start off with the managers. You know, we need to do this by this date. We need to do that by this date. We need to do something else by the next day. So the manager's a key in developing the agenda to make sure you get enough information before you make a decision, for example. So I always look at it as a process, an ongoing process, and again, develop some rules as to how you want to handle it, because ultimately it's your meeting and you get to decide what the agenda is. One of the first items on almost every agenda item you have is the adoption of the agenda. So, you know, that's a place where you can add or subtract items on an agenda as well. But adding three items onto an agenda at the meeting is usually counterproductive. Why? Because nobody's prepared to speak about those particular topics. You know, it just makes sense to know what's going to be on the agenda in advance and not to throw 10 things on at the last minute, because quite frankly, before I became mayor in my community, I watched the city council constantly spend the first half hour undoing all the things they had done at the end of a meeting where they just tossed a bunch of items onto the agenda. And they were bad decisions. So they were actually backing up. So you make bad decisions at, 12:30 in the morning. Bad things happen when that happens. So.
So would you solicit comment from your council members on a regular basis if they had something that they wanted to include in an agenda?
Yeah.
And then meet with the city manager about that?
Yeah. Let's say, pick a topic, water rates, we should really discuss water rates. It seems like they're way too low and we're running a deficit in that particular line item all the time. So we're using general funds to fund the water department. Somebody should bring that to your attention, to the manager's attention, and then have a review of it for the commission to look at it later.
The other thing was about the liaison. That's something that we're starting, having a commissioner be a liaison. Mm-hmm. But we also have, I serve on this Parks and Rec Commission, and I'm a voting member of the Parks and Rec.
Okay.
And the city manager is a voting member of a couple on our DEA Main Street Board and the LDFA. Is it appropriate for me to be a voting member on another committee? And is it appropriate for the city manager to be a voting member on this?
You have to look at the specific board or commission and maybe the state statute that sets it up. DDA, for example, has a very specific statute on who can be a member and whether they can vote or not. It's right in the statute. So in that case, it makes a lot of sense for the manager or the mayor to be voting on those things. And that's your role in that particular community organization or board. So yes, you can and should be voting in those situations.
Anybody else have questions in the first segment here? Okay, thank you.
All right. Now we'll get into a little bit of the substance regarding the Freedom of Information Act. We're going to look at policy, what's covered, how we're responding to those things, exceptions, a couple of decisions, and then we'll get to the questions. And as I mentioned before, if you have a question, please ask it at the time, don't lose it. To understand the Freedom of Information Act, I think you got to start off with the fact that we had one for the federal level since 1966, so it's not a new concept. After President Johnson, though, there was a different president who had different items, and we ended up with the Watergate scandal, and the president accused the key lists of entities, right there in the old office of, who was on their desk. And there was a real backlash against that. So the response to that by the Michigan legislature was the Freedom of Information Act of 76 and the Open Meetings Act of 1976. As I mentioned before, I've been a public official for quite a long time. I was actually on a Board of Education in January of 1977, and I can tell you that the Open Meetings Act really did change the way business was done at school district. There's a couple ways of looking at the Sunshine Laws. One is to really, shine a bunch of light on things and make everybody happy. And then there's a group of people that think it's a straitjacket and, prevents you from doing certain things the way you'd rather do them. Well, in both acts, you're required to be open about it, and that's not open for debate as far as the courts are concerned. So, if we look at the policy of the act, they're saying everybody except the prisoner that's serving a sentence in prison or jail are entitled to full and complete information regarding the affairs of government and those that represent them as public officials, employees that are consistent with the act. And the judicial view is very, very consistent. Almost always, they're ruling in favor of somebody who's been denied information. And the whole rationale is to allow people to participate in the democratic process so that they have the actual information and is right there for them to see. So, what are you as a city required to provide? Well, you're required to provide public records. And that is defined in the Act as being a writing which is prepared, owned, used, and in the possession of the public body from the time of its creation. And what is a writing? Well, they gave us a definition to write in the law. And it's the typical things you think of in terms of handwriting, typewriting, printing, photostatting. That's how old the open court FOIA is, because they're talking about photostatting. But this last section, other means of recording or retaining meaningful content, was thrown in there at the end. And the reason for that is this person. You don't know if you know who this is. This is Rosemary Woods, who is the secretary to the president, President Nixon. And somehow when she was leaning over to answer the phone while she had her foot on the dictation pedal, she accidentally erased 18 minutes of the Watergate tape, if you believe her testimony. There's other people that think otherwise, but we won't go there. But they really wanted to make sure the definition of a writing was very, very broad. And they didn't want any excuses in terms of the information that was being provided. So what does that really mean for us today? It means that while we have writing as, you know, typical on a piece of paper, like this here today, it also includes emails. It now includes text. It includes voicemail. It includes entries on a mobile data terminal. If you don't know what those are little machines inside the police vehicles where they can communicate with each other without having to be on the radio, so the bad guys don't necessarily know what they're talking about. However, that information is still subject to the Freedom of Information Act, depending on what is contained in that. So it's really important that you understand, just because I texted somebody certain information, it's not a writing. Well, according to the courts, it is a writing. So basic requirements for the city and for you as a commission are to appoint a FOIA coordinator. And that's a really important position in terms of that's the person that will actually be responding to the FOIA request. And I teach a whole 4-hour course for newbies that are FOIA coordinators because of the subtleties on it. I'm not going to go into that kind of detail today because that's not something you need to know. It's something your FOIA coordinator needs to know. One thing I will recommend, do not appoint a procrastinator as your FOIA coordinator. And why? It's right there. You only have 5 days to respond, 5 business days to respond to a request. And you get one singular extension of 10 days. So if that request sits on a desk for 4 days and the person looks at it and goes, oh, well, they want a stack of documents this tall, you'll be in trouble responding to that request in a timely fashion.
So if someone requested a stack of information this big, we have to fulfill that within 5 days, or that FOIA coordinator has to fulfill that in 5 days?
Yes, if there's a couple of techniques, again, if the stack is this high off the floor, you can require a deposit, a good faith deposit, and sometimes that makes the FOIA request go away. You are entitled to certain amounts of money to respond to the FOIA request. So if they're overly burdensome abroad, it's a problem. If you're looking for the minutes of the May 1st meeting, you know, those are 2-3 pages long, give it to them. Or show them the website that you put it on. It was truly amazing how many FOIA requests we had that just went away when we put all the information on the website. You know, it's right there. Our agenda, it's right there. All the backup information, it's right there. You can download it, you can print it, you can bring it to the meeting if you want. Just be as open as you can with that. But they only have 5 days to respond, or if it's a big one, you know, they can request a 10-day extension. but they have to.
So the extension is in part a response to them. If they need more time to respond to that FOIA request.
Yeah, so then they have a total of 15 days to respond. And by the way, the clock stops as soon as you make the request for the deposit. So you request the deposit early on in the process. That's what I was saying. Don't appoint a procrastinator in the position you want. Look at that. We're talking about a lot of documents. So you want to request that 10-day extension fairly early on in that situation as well and get the deposit request out promptly. But that's something that your FOIA coordinator hopefully will be well-schooled in. And I'm just trying to let you know why the FOIA coordinator is going to contact you if they need your information or certain documents that you have. And they'll do it, again, fairly promptly in the request.
So I got a question for Mike then, kind of like our current best practices. I know the city clerk is our FOIA coordinator. Do we have like a expense or do we collect a deposit if someone came in and said, hey, I need, you know, this information because I know there's been some and I've got emails on some FOIA requests that haven't been honored, whether it was due to the information that they were trying to seek. Do we have like a best practice of, you know, if they're requesting this, this is going to be a fee. If they request this, it's a simple email that we can share. There's no fee there. Yeah.
And we have a fee schedule associated with that.
Yeah, there's the FOIA statute has been amended to require you to have policies and procedures in place now.
Right, that's what I was wondering. Was the one individual that called me was like, hey, I was trying to get this FOIA request, but I was told that I have to pay for these paper copies. Mm-hmm. Now, I know I've done FOIA requests where I didn't have to pay for the copies, and I just was wondering if there's like a set standard of when will there be a deposit for a certain information and when is there not a deposit?
When it gets to a certain amount.
Okay.
They have to be fairly large or something of that nature. Okay. I think it spells it out. So, like, all right, just talking to a gentleman yesterday, who's looking at, who's doing like a background check on a building that he's looking to purchase or a client who's, they're doing like an environmental background on it. And they want to know, you know, what they can use the building for. And we basically just said, okay, and I called him and said, hey, this is the zoning district it's in. You want to look at the zoning ordinance and here's where it is on its website. Does that meet your needs? And he said, yes, but he still wanted it confirmed in writing, so.
Yeah, and again, because the timelines are tight, you know, get back to the FOIA coordinator as soon as you get the request because they need the information and they need to get it out to the person requesting the information.
But also, to be clear, I mean, it's not, you know, just because someone, you know, called and said, hey, you know, Mike, I want this information, so I'm just going to drop down there and get that, make sure it's there. The FOIA request is a formal, definitely.
Right.
And
right.
Has to be, and that procedure has to be followed. Right. Just to clear that.
Chris, what can you give an example of something we may have as individual commissioners that could be requested under FOIA?
Here's a good one. Our office is in the Republic of Ann Arbor. Sometimes it's kind of an interesting city. And during a meeting, commission, I think they called themselves a council, they were actually texting each other back and forth, making fun of a citizen that was speaking at a given time. So somebody pointed that, you know, what was the text going back and forth? And the city was required by a circuit court judge there in Washtenaw County to hand over those texts. Those individuals weren't elected the next time, which is a different issue, but you know, you might think this is just a personal communication between me and the two of you, but because the three of us make up the majority of the commission, you know, it's public information, it's FOIA-able, so it might only be on your phone. And we're going to talk in a moment about the important court case that says just that. So there is certain information that will only be accessible on your devices. So be careful.
So if we ask a question or have an email exchange with the city manager individually, is that something that could be FOIA'd?
Yes. Yes.
So we would want to use appropriate language in those sorts of things?
Absolutely. Assume that anything that you send out electronically, whether it's an email, a text, you know, whatever, assume that the public will read this someday. And if you do that, it'll tone down your language to help. You know, call somebody, you know, but you're really thinking about them, you know, use a different adjective instead of that. It's really common sense. You know, think before you write it, and then definitely sit on it for a while before you send it, because it might be on the front page of the, you know, local paper or something. There's an interesting Attorney General's opinion out there. Again, assuming the stack of documents is this tall, and you've already agreed, you've sent the person a note that says, yeah, we're getting them copied as soon as we can. You're not necessarily held to the 15 days, but if you're batching it out, you can get that done in a timely fashion. You can't wait 6 months, but you know, if you're getting it out, you know, 3 days late because there were 3,000 copies as opposed to just two or three pages from the minutes, that's what we're talking about. And the other interesting thing about the Freedom of Information Act is that you don't have to create or compile documents that don't exist. I want to know, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, you don't have that document. Maybe the state of Michigan has it, and you can say, oh, by the way, the state keeps that data, but we don't keep it here. You're not required to go out and create it. You're not required to go get it for somebody else or from somebody else. So that's an important distinction in the Freedom of Information. If you have the document, though, then you need to follow proper procedures and see whether certain exemptions do apply. And speaking of exemptions, these are some of the common ones that you'll probably be dealing with as it comes. This, you know, it would be really nice to know what George did on the contract before I have to submit my bid. So we don't have that under FOIA. There's a specific exemption in there for that. Test questions and answers. Yeah, I'd love to go into a test where I know all the questions and where I know all the answers. Those are fun kind of tests, but you don't have to give those out. Your tentative bargaining agreements don't have to be released until they're actually adopted by both parties under the collective bargaining agreement. And here's another one that's used quite a lot. You know, the gory photos that the police had to take after the terrible accident. The Crime Victims Rights Act protects a lot of that information, so you're not watching the horror flick on, you know, the nightly news. Like, they would really like to show it, you know, all the, you know, dismembered bodies from the, you know, terrible crash, but victims have rights too in this state, so that's really important. Another important exemption under FOIA is privileges that exist, and probably the one that will pertain to you most is the attorney-client privilege. When you speak with your attorney and you're trying to get a, you know, direct opinion from the attorney on whatever topic it might be, that remains the privilege of the city, not the attorney, by the way. So the city can waive that privilege at some point in time if it wants to, but individual commissioners shouldn't be waiving the attorney-client privilege. It should be done by the body, by your commission as a whole, a majority. And attorney-client privilege has to do with the actual advice, the events leading up to the advice being given, the particular facts that might be relevant, that may or may not be known to the general public. So it's important to keep those documents confidential, and the FOIA coordinator would definitely claim privilege on that sort of thing. Any questions on that one? because it's a fairly common thing that actually occurs in a lot of communities. Other exemptions exist are kind of a disclosure or an invasion of privacy, which is kind of hard to define all the time, but it usually involves personal, intimate details. For example, the police responded to a person passing out, but the person happened to be on the toilet and, you know, cracked their head open. And, you know, it's described in graphic detail in the police report. They might redact that particular thing because it's neither here nor there whether they were on the toilet or not when they passed out, sort of thing. And the other critical component of the privacy exemption is whether or not it helps the general public understand about government. So, for example, there's nothing that you'll learn about the government just because the person happened to be sitting on the toilet, you know, in that particular example that I gave. So it's kind of one of the more delicate and interesting things that we do in terms of trying to interpret whether the privacy exemption will apply. Oftentimes the city attorney has to give you an opinion on something like that because it might be real close to the edge.
Who makes the decision on what gets rejected?
The FOIA coordinator, sometimes with and without the help of the city attorney. I can tell you many times I would actually, you know, be called down to City Hall and, you know, let's go over this document line by line and see what's, you know, good and what's bad. Especially as it deals with crimes, because law enforcement wants to keep everything contained, but certain things in that report would give the bad guys, you know, oh, they're on to me and I'm going to flee. So you have to be real careful.
But there should be, I think there's an exemption for that, because the case is not closed yet.
Again, it still requires it to interfere with the law enforcement proceeding. So that's the important distinction. Our firm represented a major city where a child actually killed his father with an axe. And it had been on the 911 call. Another brother was in the house giving a literally blow-by-blow kind of description of what was going on. And of course the news media wanted that tape in the worst way. And we knew that if we would have given that tape out, that defendant would never have gotten a fair trial. It just was impossible. It was a snuff tape, that's really what it was. Mm-hmm. And we basically drew a line in the sand and said, no, we're not going to do it. And to their credit, the media never really challenged it either. Because it was obvious, it was nothing of value to learn from the tape that hadn't already been described. You know, the act had been committed, everybody knew what that act was. You didn't need to hear it in graphic detail where the father was pleading for his life. So generally, personnel records are not, other than law enforcement, exempt. So somebody can come in and request a personnel record of some of the employees here. However, certain information contained within that personnel file will be exempt. For example, their social security number, their home phone, their address may be redacted. Definitely can be used by some people to try and hack into their accounts if they have banking information, for example, in there. So it doesn't mean you just take the personnel file and give it to them. It still requires a FOIA coordinator to go through that, you know, personnel file line by line to make sure you're not disclosing something that's a private detail. As we mentioned before, the police have two different sections of Freedom of Information Act. But if you're interfering with law enforcement proceedings, that's number one. That's the one that probably gets misunderstood the most, but it's disclosing something that would interfere with the process later on down the road or catching the criminal in the first place. And then things like operational plans are exempt under the Freedom of Information Act. And the reason is obvious. If I know how the police are going to respond to the bank robbery in progress, I've got one up on the police, and I can, you know, interfere with their ability to combat crime. So I'm not going to give out the manual on how we're going to actively respond to a shooter or that kind of information. And generally, all of their personal records are exempt. And again, the reason should be obvious. Bad guys don't like cops. They would like to go back and hurt them or their family members. And actually, that's one of the reasons why my advice to police officers is don't be on social media. Don't post pictures of your kids. Somebody is out there that doesn't like you because you arrested me and gave me my just desserts. So, you know, I always tell officers to be very, very careful about what kind of information they're publishing. So, remember, this act was created in 1976. These things, you know, this computer that's sitting on the desk here was science fiction in 1976. This cell phone has more computing power than the word excursion module that landed on the moon. Literally. So they were never thinking of these things back in 1976 in the way we do business. So again, there was not email. There was not text messaging. Social media didn't exist. And today, it all falls within that broad definition of a writing that we have in the statute now. Courts have made that really clear. So what does that mean? It means that the only place that I can get the information between, you know, you three texting about whatever is on your phone, a circuit court judge is going to probably tell you, turn over your phone, we're going to clone the hard drive and go through it to find out whether there's information on it that relates to city business. So if you have a city email account, I don't know if you all individually have that, but I strongly recommend that you have one and do all your city business on that. Why? Because when a FOIA request comes in and says, I want to know everything that Commissioner Mooney said to this particular citizen by way of an email transaction, we don't have to go to your computer. We don't have to go to your email on your phone. We've got it all there right at City Hall, and FOIA form, you can turn it all over easily without bothering you. And I think that's an important change. And you should think about so remember, if the only place that they store the information is on your device, the judge may order you to produce it. And
where is it?
Yeah.
It's a serious question to that. So, you know, we were told just, you know, created an email, you know, for the city, mine's commission will be at gmail.com. So consequently, because I use that on my computer, they can just take my entire computer versus
they'll clone your hard drive and, you know.
Tim's letter. I'm a stupid guy when it comes to technology. I don't like that. I don't care.
Well, let me get to the case involving this. This was a really important case called Howell Education Association versus School Board there. And there were two really important concepts in that case. The court kind of created a brand new exception that does not exist in the law, but said there's certain, they wanted every email that every teacher had sent out since time immemorial. The school district had allowed the teachers to use it for their own personal stuff and send messages back and forth. And the court basically said, some of this stuff involves, you know, Mike sending a note off to his wife and saying, I'm going to be late today, would you pick up the kids from daycare? And the court said, what does that have to do with government? It has absolutely nothing to do with government. It, you know, is a quick email to say, you know, pick up some milk and bread on your way home from the store or from work at the store. How does that help anybody understand what government is doing? Doesn't have a thing to do with it. So they kind of created this new exception that they call purely personal communication. So that was, you know, pretty good ruling from a perspective. But what they also said was the content of the message is the more important factor rather than where it is stored. So the how case stands for the proposition that if the information is only left now on my cell phone, they're going to get a copy of my cell phone hard drive. It's that simple. So again, I caution you about doing any city business or city-related business on your own personal Yahoo or AOL or Gmail or whatever, because you might have lots of things on your Gmail account that you want to keep more private or create, you know.
That didn't answer anything.
I was going to say,
we were told to create our own.
Yeah.
Because we can't do it here.
Okay.
And or because we don't want to do it here, I don't care. But this is real serious.
Yeah.
I use that, and I don't have anything to hide. I'll let you go through my phone right now. I'm not worried about that. But I was told that, you know, everything that I do on that Gmail between any of us and Michael, then I'm fine because I'm not doing anything,
right,
any city business on my computer. You know, but I use the same keyboard to tell Michael, thank you for this note. You know, Hugh, thanks. Here's how I see that. Tom,
and it's going to be really easy to get that information from one account, one thing. And
yes,
you can talk, you know, to the city attorney as you're responding to their request. Not the city attorney, city FOIA coordinator. All of my information is at, you know, this.com, and I've saved everything here. It all is.
Yep.
That will be acceptable. That really will work.
Okay.
Because it'll be easier for you to find. It'll be complete if you don't delete it all. Because as I was mentioning before,
I haven't deleted the single thing.
As I mentioned before, once you electronically send something out, you don't own it anymore. Mm-hmm. Other people may or may not have a copy of it. It might come back on the front pages of the Ann Arbor News, as those council members found out after they were, you know, required to turn over that information. So
let me ask this question to better understand, because so I have a commission email specifically to do business as a city commissioner.
Okay.
That email is used on my personal laptop, it's used on my personal phone, it's used on my personal iPad and the city's iPad. Now, if someone needed to get information, we did a FOIA request, would I have to turn this in,
no,
and they're copying all these hard drives?
It's, again, if it's the only place that the information is on.
Right, so my phone number that's on the city website, if someone texts me or calls me, and I respond to that text or respond to that call, could they copy the hard drive off this then?
Again, it depends on whether you can get that information to the FOIA coordinator without the need to do that. Where I have seen people get in trouble is when they say, oh, this is mine. It's my own personal device.
Right.
You can't get that information. That's when you get in trouble. If you assume that they can get the information, you can make it as easy or as hard for the FOIA coordinator to get the information.
Yeah.
Make it easy.
Okay.
And then show all that information back to the FOIA coordinator, and they'll decide what applies and what doesn't apply.
Okay.
That'll be very helpful. But just because it's your own personal device doesn't shield it from a FOIA request.
Right.
I guess that's the warning I'm trying to give. We have a lot of materials on FOIA, and I gave you, it's in your packet, on different items for FOIA, so it's a long, detailed subject. Like I said, I teach the basic FOIA 101 to coordinators that you go through for all the material. Actual court cases, you don't need to know all the court cases, but your FOIA coordinator. And with that, that's the end. end of the FOIA presentation. Did you want to take a quick break for dinner?
Could I ask a question, though?
Oh, absolutely.
Going back to the city manager role and commission, this come up recently. So it's outlined in our city charter, the city manager hires department heads with the consent of the city commission, but we don't participate at all in any of the hiring or interviews or anything like that. So what's the point of the city commission approving an appointment if they don't know hardly anything about the candidate being nominated or being recommended?
Well, usually at the point where a candidate is recommended for appointment and, you know, they'll attach a resume, I would assume, I guess, the city managers that always work for the city, where I was from, would always do that anyway. I guess it's so that you can become familiar with the person. If you wanted to do your own background check, you can do it, I guess. Usually the manager will have vetted that person, done an actual, depending on the nature of the position, even a police check on the person. So run a criminal background check on certain positions. So it's important that you just have a say in it. It's usually a standard provision that's in a number of charters of a certain age. It isn't in every charter. Usually the manager is pretty free to hire the person that they eventually do without needing to go to the consent, but the consent is just a requirement of the charter, so you have to do it. You could eliminate that section of the charter, with the appropriate charter amendment, if that's the way you saw it working. But just knowing a little bit about the person that's being proposed for a position, the manager has to explain why Mike over here is the best bookkeeper for the position. It's just one of those kind of things that is frequently seen in a city charter, but not universally seen.
One thought that I had is, our city, Mike does a good job with an interview committee of just having a member of the city commission as one of a 4 or 5 member interview committee. Would that be an appropriate thing for a commissioner?
Once we'll cover this in the Open Meetings Act section, once you would have two commissioners in, you've got a whole open meetings question. So it may or may not be useful, depending on the level of experience you have running a police department. Maybe I would be okay in that kind of a committee because I know how police departments work. I've defended police officers my whole career. I understand what their job is. But I may not know the same amount of things about recreation, for example. So I don't know, just simply having a commissioner that doesn't know the particular area very well, it doesn't necessarily make sense. The interviewee would probably be a little bit intimidated that, a commissioner has to be on this interview. When the commissioner isn't necessarily involved with the day-to-day activities of running whatever department it would be. I don't know how many positions you have in your charter that require consent, but it's usually the important ones.
Yes, it's just our department head.
Yeah. Not, the guy that's actually picking up the trash on Wednesday. Anything else in those roles? Or the Freedom of Information Act? Why don't we take that break then, and I'll turn it over to Mike.
Ethan LaFou. Okay. There's plates in the office.
Mike, do I go ahead and stop it? Should I stop it? Okay.